Hello and welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts at Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir and I'm joined as always by Coutts CIO Alan Higgins. Each week on Need to Know, we look at the three things investors need to know for the week ahead. Alan, what do we need to know this week?
Good morning, Sarah. So three things. I think we'll look at the data. We won't always look at the data, but I think there's an interesting aspect, a quick summary of the data.
Yeah.
And in The Economist, theories of inflation.
Yes. You
know, and I've mentioned before that nearly everything we do is theories, nothing we can absolutely prove.
Yeah.
But quite, I would say, at risk of saying unsatisfactory article on theories of inflation in The Economist, but I'll go through it and give my own views. And before you switch off, I know that sounds dull. One, you look forward to me having a rant in that one. And the third one is that we've got a good one. We've got the billionaires, our favourite Elon Musk and Zuckerberg, about to have a fight.
I know. I'm looking forward to getting your thoughts on that. But there's a kind of wider, more serious point, is there, to discuss about Meta and Twitter particularly, rather than Tesla in this case. But yeah, okay. Well, I'll look forward to getting your thoughts and maybe perhaps a tip on who we think would win that that fight. But let's start off with something a bit more serious. Data Watch, Fed is data driven. We're all watching data at the moment. What are the key pieces of data that have come out and are coming out over the next sort of few days?
So in general, if we focus on the US, I'm going to cover the US, UK and China. If we focus on the US, outside of manufacturing, data remains pretty robust, you have to say. And you know, it seems to be hard to put the US economy into recession. We had the big employment report last week. Main point there was wages were a bit sticky. A bit worse than expected. Again, go back a year, market would have sold off a lot on this kind of data. Not this time, but the big one in the US coming up is inflation.
Yeah.
And expected, the average forecast is 3.1%, so a big fall. And obviously 3.1 is close to the magic 2 point something. So let's see about that. So that's in the United States. I think in summary, US inflation falling much faster than the rest of the world, which we'll come to. And just on the UK, we just today, as we speak, wages again, you know, data worse than expected, 6.9% year over year wages. Yeah. In contrast, the US number was 4.4%. So, the Bank of England seems to have a lot more work to do.
Yeah.
And we've talked about that, but I think China's really interesting right now.
Yes. Well, they've got no inflation at all, have they? Or virtually
none. Exactly. Well, yeah, exactly right. 0.0%, the latest data. Yeah. It was expected to be low, but zero. And producer prices in China down 5%. So what's going on? How can China have zero inflation?
Yeah.
The US went to 9. Okay, it's back to 4. UK up at 8.7. What's going on? And I think we'll link into theories of inflation.
Well, yeah, because I was going to say, because they've had a fairly, they've been one of the central banks that have been fairly loose with their monetary policy, haven't they? So, okay, well before we get onto that then, so just to run through, we had that jobs report. The US, in the US, wage increases is still fairly sticky. Wage inflation is fairly sticky, but it is, we've got CPI out on the 12th, and that is expected to fall down to 3.1%, which is getting much closer to that sort of target figure. UK wage inflation is proving to be very challenging for the Bank of England. But in China, we're seeing CPI at virtually zero, and PPI's come down substantially. Okay, so let's then lead us on to our second point, which was the Economist article that you read, and I actually had a look at it as well. On the theories behind what's driving inflation and why this divergence in China, US, UK?
So they're looking at the theories. That, you know, good news, you don't need to buy The Economist. If there's anything super interesting, we'll bring it to the
Read it for you.
Right? Probably get sued by The Economist now.
We're giving them a plug, so we should get somebody on who wants to come and talk to us.
The Economist is fantastic. You know, this is just one article. So look, they've got an article on the theory of inflations where academics are out there saying, you know, what caused it. And they put it down to three. One, fairly obvious, the energy increase.
Yeah.
Two, low unemployment. And the third one, I'm almost going to say bizarrely, greedflation. Have you come across greedflation?
Well, yes. Well, I have now because I read the article, which is essentially, if I paraphrase, it's that it's corporations putting their prices up because they can, because everything else, things are costing them more, so they're putting their prices up, and it's companies taking advantage of that environment to profit from it.
It is, and also, but you could argue that employees in a tight labour market are taking advantage and asking for higher price rises. So, these are more what is happening now rather than the cause of inflation. And yeah, absolutely accept that companies, they have a fiduciary responsibility. Yes, to society, but also importantly to shareholders. That's how it works. Yeah. If they can raise prices, if supply is greater than demand, of course they're going to raise prices. And we have seen that. Energy, we know that's big, especially in Europe. Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, it was absolutely, energy prices absolutely exploded in Europe. So fair, that's, you know, that's a theory.
But with energy, are we not talking about, because the Economist article is talking about core inflation being sticky, isn't it? And that doesn't include energy.
That's right. I think energy is a good candidate for kicking it off. Yeah. I think where the Economist article gets muddled, dare I say, I say with great humility, is what started it off with what's going on now. Absolutely, what's going on now, yeah, greedflation, if you want to call it that. Wages, we just talked about wages, yeah, absolutely, but what kicked it off I think is more interesting, and that's where, you know, I'm about to have a rant because one, energy prices, but it's not just energy prices. So because just like any investor, I've got loads of things wrong, you know, you're quick to hold me account, but one thing, how much did I rant about what the expansionary fiscal policy when rates were zero?
I think since we started Need to Know, I think you've been around.
Yeah, and prior when on internal calls, right? So at Coutts. So look, this is the situation. When rates were zero, money supply, monetarism, it's part of it. If I give you some of the data. So quantitative easing from 2009 to 2020, any increase in inflation? No. What did money supply do? In the United States, basically averaged about 5%. In the UK, averaged actually close to zero. So no money supply growth. But
so where was that money going from that QE?
Well, now we're on to a technical part. QE, the way to look at QE is fairly much more technical. It is literally a pension fund, your local Wiltshire pension fund. Basically, Goldman Sachs ringing them up, buying the gilts off the Wiltshire Pension Fund and handing them over to the Bank of England. Mm. So Goldman Sachs, in this case, picking on Goldman Sachs, purely acting as agent and passing the gilts on. And the Wiltshire Pension Fund, instead of owning gilts because they were taken out at very expensive levels, as an example, would buy maybe some corporate bonds.
Okay.
You know, but no new money. I've never thought that QE generated inflation. In contrast, what the US and the UK did in 2020, absolutely. And they did it for the right reasons. We had a pandemic.
Yeah.
Okay, absolutely. So US spent 26% on GDP on their various stimuluses, and money supply went to 25% year over year. Money supply. So that was real money. So how did the US do it? The US put cash, hard cash, into people's bank accounts.
Helicopter money, it was called, wasn't it?
And we had the furlough scheme here and various free loans, all really important. But this is what I think the central bank, this is the rant. Why did central banks keep rates zero then? And this is not hindsight, because I was,
you were saying it's all the time.
I was ranting about it at the time because it was driving me crazy keeping rates at zero or negative in the Eurozone when we had this much. In the UK, by the way, where our measure of money supply was basically zero, we went to a little under 15%. So it was interesting. The US was the biggest expansion. But the good news is, where is the money supply now in the United States? Negative year over year. So right. Higher interest rates and the removal of these, the fiscal stimulus is starting to fade. It's really come off. Similar in the UK. UK money supply is really weakened off, also negative. So good news is absolutely, we're looking at a very favorable picture. And then linking in with China, haven't had any inflation.
No.
And a very strong economy normally. So their money supply, you'd expect to be stronger, but no deviation, no stimulus. Basically stayed at 8% year over year, which is normal money supply growth for China.
Okay.
And I first learned about the theory of money supply driving inflation when I started my career, like late 1980s. Professor Tim Congdon, well-known name. I think he has been on the UK Monetary Policy Committee. He was one of the first to really push it. And look, absolutely accept. It's one, it's only a theory, and two, there's other things going on. Of course there is. But I mean, there's strong evidence here, isn't there? The US situation, the UK Europe situation. Okay, we've had energy as a big issue in Europe. In contrast with China, money supply was the problem. The print, so not the quantitative easing, the real printing of money, I'll call it.
Yeah, exactly. Because then you get into that situation then where you've got too much money chasing too little in the way of goods and services, haven't you? So inevitably you're going to get inflation.
Exactly, especially when monetary policy was so loose. So you had the double whammy of big fiscal expansion, huge increase in the money supply, and really borrow money at zero, which, you know, will come to Twitter. That's exactly what Twitter did.
Yeah. Just one final question, though, on this. Is it fair to say that that sort of monetary policy impacts different regions differently? So does it have a different impact on emerging markets to how it would impact on developed markets? So is it has less of an inflationary impact on emerging markets than it does on developed markets? I mean, like we're seeing with China.
Yeah, but no, because what you've actually tended to see in places like Argentina, Venezuela, huge increases in money supply. So, so if any in kind of extreme, those are more they're developing markets rather than emerging markets, frontier markets rather than emerging markets even. But you tend to see real inflationary pressures associated with very high money supply growth in those countries. So, but I think where you're onto something is that in a vibrant emerging market, frontier market, higher money supply is a norm.
Yeah.
Because there is more vibrant, stronger growth. Just like in China, it is a norm. So you do have to make an adjustment. But if you look at the data for Argentinian money supply, it's all, you know, in times of Argentinian inflation, for example, you see it go through the roof.
Okay. All right then. Okay. So before we get on to the final point then, just sort of the key things there, then what we're talking about is that there are various conflicting theories about what causes inflation. I mean, we know what's contributing it at the moment, but what is it that first kicks it off? And your point is that it's not QE that creates inflation, but it's, in inverted commas, I'm doing bunny ears here, real money printing, like the money, like the sort of the policies we saw during COVID, where we saw money actually going into people's bank accounts, you know, helicopter money, furlough schemes, and that's what's driven the inflation that we're currently still trying to battle with. Is that essentially what we're saying?
Yeah, that's a perfect summary, Sarah.
Good. I do pay attention sometimes. All right, then. Last but not least, I mean, we're sort of treating this as a lighthearted thing, but there's a serious story behind it. But let's talk about the brawling billionaires, because I love a bit of alliteration. Our friend Elon Musk and his, well, he's not his friend, he's his sworn enemy, I think, isn't he? Mark Zuckerberg. Yeah. What are they up to?
Well, we'll come to the finance part, but let's do the fun bit first.
Yes.
So it really looked like a fight may happen, because Zuckerberg's really into his jiu-jitsu.
Yes.
Elon Musk claims he was good at one stage, and he claims he's so big he's just going to lie on Elon Musk and suffocate him. I think you've got a 5'7" guy versus a 6'2", 6'3" guy, but
something
the game is different. So So where's your money on? Who's going to win?
You know what? I wouldn't. I think I might have a couple of quid on Elon Musk, actually. I wouldn't put it past him to just, as you say, just to lie on Mark Zuckerberg and just, you know, squash him.
Well, as a vertically challenged person myself, 5'7" or 5'7½", just like Mark Zuckerberg, I'm going to go with him because he looks pretty proficient at jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
And I think he can handle. And I used to, as a very short person, I was in the Bristol University karate team. And my one triumph at the university championships was beating one big guy. I got hammered by the rest. But there is a way of beating big guys. So I'm going to go with him. But let's see. But the serious point is that coming back to is that Twitter is under commercial threat from this new Twitter Threads.
Yes.
What do you think of it? You tried it?
Well, I think it's interesting because being an Instagram user, they're very clever in the way they've set it up. That you literally just lift and shift. You move your Instagram account to Threads. You've got all your followers there already. You've got all the people that you already follow. So they're going to get to that number that they need to really be commercial very quickly. I think they said something like 70 million users already by the weekend, which seems remarkable. But it's obviously they make it very easy for people to set up their accounts based on an existing Instagram profile. And you've got your followers there with you as well, which seems like that critical mass. That was the phrase I was looking for. They can get to that critical mass very quickly, can't they?
They can, yeah. I had a little look myself. My Instagram is only ever fishing stuff and cars, so pretty dull. I don't go fishing enough these days, sadly. So, not enough finance on there for me yet on Threads. Mm. Twitter has a lot of finance stuff. I've been a bit inactive on Twitter, but now we're doing this podcast. I'll put it on Twitter every time also. But this is a worry. Okay, so Elon Musk bought Twitter with $13 billion of debt when interest rates were zero.
Yeah.
And the rate was circa 4-6% over zero. Well, actually over cash. Well, now it's 4-6% over five.
Yeah.
So that interest, and it's $13 billion debt. And there's so-called bridge debt, which is basically like a bridging loan. Well, it is a bridging loan. Which Morgan Stanley has 800 million, Barclays, our own Barclays, has over 600 million allegedly. And there's another 2 billion of debt shared amongst four banks, including Morgan Stanley and Barclays. So it's already struggling as a business, as we know, Twitter.
Yeah.
And so there's a pretty serious debt out there. Yeah. Look, the banks are in better shape these days. They can afford these kind of write-offs. And he is paying the interest for now. And he can really afford it. His Tesla shareholders soared because Tesla is part of the Magnificent Seven stocks, which we've covered previously.
Yeah.
So, but still, if I was a Twitter debt holder, I would be feeling a bit edgy.
Yeah. I mean, worst case scenario, Twitter collapses and he defaults on all that debt. What happens?
In theory, this is the funny thing, the banks and the bondholders now own Twitter. So Barclays Bank will become an owner of Twitter.
Okay.
Which is like their worst nightmare. In practice, what they're trying to do is sell it as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And try and get some money back. But the ownership reverts to, just like a mortgage, if you default on your mortgage,
yeah,
the ownership reverts to the bank who provided you the mortgage.
Maybe Mr. Zuckerberg might be able to pick up a bargain there then.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ego going on. I would sense that whilst Tesla's soaring and doing well, it's a mere distraction for Elon Musk and he can so afford it. But still, that is risky debt, you know. And I, as an investor, I like diversified risky debt because you get paid for it.
Yeah.
But as an individual investment, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. Okay. All right then. Well, yeah. I mean, it's as I say that there's a joke there about the brawling billionaires, but there's a more serious point, which is the fact that Elon Musk took out a huge amount of debt to buy Twitter, when interest rates were zero. Now interest rates are, you know, much higher, and it's costing him an awful lot of money. And there's a lot of big institutions holding that debt. It'll be interesting to see, well, will they have a fight? Well, we'll wait and see. I'm sure there's going to be a big audience for that if they do. Bets are being taken as to who would be the winner on the night. And there's an ongoing rivalry between Meta and Twitter. It'd be interesting to see. I think we're going to have Howard Sparks on when the Magnificent Seven start reporting their earnings, because that's going to be a biggie, isn't it? Because I think expectations are they're not going to report any growth in earnings, are they, despite having this phenomenal growth in valuation this year?
Yeah, so it starts with the banks this week, but the Magnificent Seven need to deliver either this quarter, or just like Nvidia, you know, pointed to future strong growth. So we will see. It will be interesting. And yeah, we have to get Howard on here to cover earnings season.
Yeah, no, we're definitely going to get him coming on. Okay, well, thank you very much, Alan. A reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment advice, are accurate at the time of recording, and are subject to change. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining me today. Don't forget to check out the podcast page on Coutts.com. And of course, you can subscribe to Need to Know via iTunes, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. And you can access previous episodes, including a recent one, which Alan and I recorded, where we discussed the rationale for investing in equities in a higher interest rate environment. Some really interesting stats and sort of research on that, and what history tells us about the impact of higher interest rates on in equities. And I mean, that's a theme that's going to run until the end of this year and probably into the beginning of next year as well. That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with more Need to Know. Until then, bye for now.